last week in our study of John. We thought it means about what it means to be the true vine. That's the picture drawn for us earlier in this chapter. And also what it means to be grafted into union with the vine as branches. And that, of course, is what believers are. We are the branches. And those branches are there for a purpose, and that purpose is to bear good fruit, as it tells us. And that means simply to do the good works that God has created for us to do, that we may glorify Him and reflect Christ to the world that desperately needs Him, so that others may be drawn to Him and encouraged in Him. So that's kind of what we looked at last week. And I think I always need to remind myself, and perhaps you need reminding as well, that those good works, that fruit is not the means of our salvation. It's not the way to our salvation. In essence, it's the sign of it. It's the clue that it is real, because in fact, a good tree does bear fruit. It's the sign that we are saved. It's not the means of our salvation. Salvation only comes as the free gift of God through Christ alone, not by anything that we do or earn or say. It is an undeserved gift to us from Him. Totally undeserved. We are unworthy. And Jesus will remind us of that very thing in verse 16 today on this topic of good works, for that's what it is. The text, both prior to this passage and also here, indicates that those works are necessary. They are necessary in order to shed a favorable light on Jesus to the world and to draw those to Him, the lost to Him. But it is also voluntary, these good works. It's not forced upon us. We have a distinct role in cooperating in being fruit bearers, good branches. And that is that we choose or we choose not to obey the commands of Jesus to do these good works, and then we cooperate with the Holy Spirit in doing them. A lot of this is what we've touched upon, and a lot of which we'll touch upon again today. We have a voluntary part, no doubt, in all this, and it is driven by, first, the love that Jesus has for us. It is driven by, first, His love for us, and second, by that reciprocal love that we are to have for Him as believers. He loves us first. We are to love Him back. And we should, if we have an inkling of what He has done for us, of what He has saved us from. Jesus encourages us then towards being those fruit-bearing branches He wants us to be. So that takes us to our text today, kind of a summary of last week and also a setup for this one, John 15, 12 through 17. Hear the word of the Lord. This is my commandment, that you love one another as I have loved you. Greater love has no one than this, that someone lays down his life for his friends. You are my friends if you do what I command you. No longer do I call you servants, for the servant does not know what his master is doing. But I have called you friends, for all that I have heard from my Father I have made known to you. You did not choose me, but I chose you and appointed you that you should go and bear fruit, and that your fruit should abide, so that whatever you ask the Father in my name, He may give it to you. These things I command you, so that you will love one another. The grass withers, the flower fades, but the word of the Lord stands forever. Now, it is so easy to say that we love someone. I love this movie star, or that sports figure, or even a politician, or a musician. I really love him or her. Especially, it's easy to say that for someone we don't see or know personally. Even, and especially, God, for instance. It's easy to say that we love God. Jesus' command, though, that we see in verse 12 has to do with showing love for Him we can't see. by showing it to those that we can, to other people. The sign of our love for Jesus then is really made evident, not by saying that we love Him, but by loving other people, other human beings. I hope you're following with me. We can say we love God until the cows come home. The proof is in the pudding in loving other people. The Apostle John will go on and write more extensively about this, explaining it even further in his epistles. In 1 John 4:20, he says this, and this is a hard writing indeed. If anyone says, "I love God," and hates his brother, he is a liar. For he who does not love his brother whom he has seen cannot possibly love God whom he has not seen. So in verse 12 then, Jesus is tying a true love for Jesus back to love for other people. He first loves us. If we truly love Him, we are to, in essence, pay it forward. We are to love people, especially other Christians. And yes, it's easy to say we love someone. I love Jesus. I love you. It's very easy for those words to roll off our tongue. But remember, this is love from a biblical perspective, not a worldly one. This is the Bible's definition of love, and love in the Bible is not nearly as much a feeling as it is an action. It is doing much more than it is feeling. It is a work. It is a gesture. It is a kindness. It is an investment of time and money and heart. It is all those things and more. So much of the skepticism, I think, that the world has often felt for Christianity comes simply from watching the way the church can often tear itself apart, of splitting and fragmenting and arguing. And those who are supposed to be showing the love of Christ to one another, in fact, are often fighting and slandering and shunning other believers. It's a sad thing. You and I have seen it, taken part in it. Paul is in dismay in 1 Corinthians 6. There, Christians are dragging one another into court, suing one another, and they're doing it in front of the Roman magistrate, the unbelieving Roman magistrate. They're making a public spectacle among things that should be dealt with within the church in a biblical fashion. Instead, it's all out in the open for all to see. They are making a mockery of the faith as a consequence, and Paul addresses that. Instead, we are to be loving one another. We are to be loving each other here in the church in a million various ways, including but not limited to forgiveness, taking time to work problems out, taking time, not putting it on the back burner, hoping it will disappear, but addressing it, taking the time out of love to deal and heal with things, giving the benefit of the doubt towards one another, not assuming the worst of each other, showing kindness, thoughtfulness, etc. A million different ways we are to love one another, right? So we are to love those that we see, especially Christians, and we're to love them through good works of all types. That's the encouragement. This models the love of Jesus for us. But it doesn't stop there. Chumley is a tiny little village not much bigger than this over in Devonshire in the south of England. On the front cover of the bulletin is a picture of a monument there commemorating World War I and World War II deaths from the village. World War I lost 29 men from that little village. 29 soldiers were slain in World War I in a village with just a few hundred people. That is a lot. That is a very high percentage. A lot of lost. Among those were two sets of brothers, Frederick and William Thorne, and Samuel John and Richard Bader. And this monument is just one of thousands in England alone. I have seen them. They are in every single town. They are displayed in prominent places. It struck them very hard there, World War I and World War II. And inscribed on this particular monument and others like them are the words that we find in verse 13 that Jesus utters today. And I'll read it in the King James because that's how they generally are inscribed there. Greater love hath no man than this, that a man lay down his life for his friends. That is on a lot of granite out there, not just in England, in the world. But I've seen it there and it strikes close to home there. And that sentiment captures this ultimate sacrifice that all those soldiers made so that their countrymen, their friends, could have freedom from the oppressors. And in both cases, those were Germans. You see, Jesus was in the process of doing this very thing as he was talking to the disciples. He was in the process of laying down his life for his friends. He had been doing that from before eternity when it was established that he would come. He would come for the sins of man to redeem them. How did he do that? He did it by laying down his life, by giving his perfection for the lost. And so as he was here talking with this inner group of disciples in these hours before his betrayal, arrest, and eventual crucifixion, the whole friends thing should have made some sense to them. I mean, they were close. They spent the last 3 years together. They loved one another. They lived, traveled. They'd been in constant companionship with Jesus for these 3 years. Even Peter, who would just in a bit deny him three times, deny that he even knew Jesus three times. But that illustrates the point I'm trying to make, you see. These were friends, right, in the sense of the word. But in another sense, they were not. They were not the friends of Jesus in the deep meaning that this word has here. They were, in fact, the enemies of Jesus. Just like all of us in our natural, fallen, sinful states. We are not the friends of Jesus in our natural persons. We are the enemies of Jesus. If you don't believe me, let's think about Romans 5 for a minute, starting at verse 6. This is Paul writing, "For while we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly." While we were still weak, at the right time, Christ died for the ungodly. For one will scarcely die for a righteous person, though perhaps for a good person one would dare even to die. But God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. I hope you understand the magnitude of this statement here. Christ died for the ungodly. God shows his love for us in that while we were still sinners, Christ died for us. We weren't great people who deserved his death, that sacrifice. We were enemies of Jesus. That's a huge one up if you think about it on the sacrifice of the English soldiers or anyone else. For they died nobly in many cases. Just as our own do. They died for their beloved countrymen, for their families, for their homes. But what Jesus did is like dying, it was like them dying to save the Germans, their enemies. It gives a whole different perspective to this notion of what a friend he is. On the scale of friendship, that's the ultimate. That doesn't get any better than that. Jesus died for people who were by their nature his enemies, who turned from him due to sin, so that they would become then his loved ones. And that is amazing. So not only are we to be modeling and practicing loving kindness, good works in many ways to one another, even as Jesus did upon his disciples and his followers and his family, we're also to be loving those that we are not naturally drawn to, even those who might be labeled as our enemies. That's the friendship Jesus saved us with. That's the kind of friendship he encourages us to through his love. So our encouragement then is to love better, both other Christians, but also those who need to be Christians, who need the salvation of Jesus. Not yet, but hopefully so. We should especially love them. Even if it requires that ultimate price in order for them to know and hear the gospel message of salvation. That's what drove all those missionaries. I know that you probably know of this. I've mentioned it in the past. This great missionary movement of the 1800s here and particularly here in England, all these young people were going out, were getting on the boats.